Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, the opposition finally get to have their say on Papua New Guinea's 2019 budget, but only after marauding police officers brought Parliament to a standstill over unpaid allowances. 10 months after the Kiribati ferry disaster, the official report is complete, but it's yet to leave the President's desk. And it's ambitious and it will be expensive, but the experts say it can be done. A massive expansion of PNG's electricity grid. Those stories to come later in the programme. But first, the island nations made it plain at the Pacific Islands Forum in Nauru earlier in the year that tackling climate change is their number one priority. And they continue to push for more drastic action on a global scale to slow down global warming. But now, during what was a world-first climate summit held in cyberspace, Vanuatu have dropped a bombshell by saying the government is examining the possibility of suing fossil fuel companies over their role in climate change. And if other countries come on board, Vanuatu is prepared to drive international class actions against other nations that are considered to be falling short of the goals set out in the Paris Agreement. As Nick Fogarty reports, Vanuatu's foreign minister says the time has come for drastic action.
Leaders from around the globe took it in turns to make an online video speech as part of the first ever Climate Vulnerable Forum virtual summit. Wedged in between big names of Oceania politics like Rudd, Rustin and Rumengesel, Vanuatu was represented by its foreign minister, Ralph Reganvanu. He had a very serious message for the world's worst climate change offenders, threatening to drag them all the way to the courtroom.
My government is now exploring all avenues to utilise the judicial system in various jurisdictions, including under international law, to shift the costs of climate protection back onto the fossil fuel companies, the financial institutions, and the governments that actively and knowingly created this existential threat to my country.
Many of Vanuatu's 82 islands sit less than a metre above sea level and are vulnerable to weather events, made clear by Cyclone Pam in 2015, which killed 15 people and caused more than $590 million in damage. Ralph Reganvanu told forum viewers that countries like his were an innocent victim of such events.
The injustice of climate change is that the impacts are felt first and hardest by those with the least responsibility for its causes. Vanuatu is on the front lines of climate change, and yet we have benefited least from the exploitation of fossil fuels that has caused it. By hiding what they knew and misrepresenting the dangers of unabated fossil fuel use, the fossil fuel industry and supportive governments have protected their high emissions profits and obstructed the changes needed to prevent or at least minimise the impacts of climate change.
Speaking to Pacific Beat following his forum address, Mr. Reganvanu said his government has been consulting legal firms in the US, UK and Europe on options for suing fossil fuel companies and for joining with affected nations in class actions against other sovereign states. He says one of the targets on its list is Australia.
Taking the fossil fuel companies, taking them to court, Vanuatu is prepared to do that by itself. When it comes to possibly taking other countries, then we would do it with many other countries, hopefully, in a kind of a multi-country class action. It could possibly be normal litigation in courts like torts and so on, but it's also likely that it's going to be under some international convention, like, for example, the World Trade Organization or the Water and Ocean Tribunals or the UNCLOS, Law of the Sea Tribunals, are similar.
Environmental group Greenpeace has greeted the announcement with excitement, saying it's truly remarkable and needs to be commended. Pacific campaigner for Greenpeace Australia Pacific, Kelvin Anthony, says Vanuatu's move is what climate leadership should look like.
If the outcome of this legal action is what we expect it to be, it's going to start a wave of further action. So, you know, it's going to diminish the moral license of the fossil fuel companies that they can push through and, you know, keep destroying our planet and keep burning coal and keep contributing to a warming planet.
The ABC has contacted several major international oil and gas companies for comment on the move, with British Petroleum declining to comment, while Chevron, Peabody, Shell and ExxonMobil are yet to respond.
Nick Fogarty there reporting on one of the key outcomes of the world's first virtual climate summit meeting. Now to Papua New Guinea, where the government's budget for 2019 has been passed, but not before some extraordinary scenes that saw members of the security forces storm Parliament in protest to what they claimed were unpaid entitlements owed to them for work during APEC. There was damage to the building and allegations of assault during the incident, which is now being investigated, and some are arguing inappropriately, by the police and correctional services. Once things calmed down, Parliament finally went into session, and as Lauren Baldy reports, it was the opposition who went on the attack over a budget which they say won't do enough for health and education and features what the Shadow Treasurer has characterised as a sudden jump in expected expenditure.
The 16 billion Kina budget, almost 6.6 billion Australian dollars, was delivered amongst the excitement of last week's APEC summit. The Treasurer, Charles Abel, struck an optimistic tone when handing it down.
We're able to go out and get financing and meet the expectations of the international community and get an overwhelmingly vote of confidence through some of our financing measures because of some of the good things we're doing in terms of the 25-point plan and discipline and those other measures that we are talking about. However, we must give equal attention on the expenditure side.
That expenditure has jumped since the budget strategy paper at the end of August. Paul Flanagan is the Director of Indo-Pacific Public Policy and Economics and was a senior advisor in the PNG Treasury.
What we saw in this budget was a very expansionary budget, an increase in expenditure of about 10%, more than a billion kina, or nearly 10% more than what he indicated would actually be coming through from his budget strategy of only 2.5 months ago. So this is a fairly big spending budget based on some very optimistic scenarios as to how the economy is going. So overall, I'd have to say this is a pretty risky budget.
In his budget reply speech on Tuesday, the Shadow Treasurer, Ian Ling Stuckey, said the government wasn't spending enough on education or health. He said after accounting for inflation, the former gets only a small increase of around 2%, while health funding has decreased. Paul Flanagan says he's surprised the health budget wasn't larger, given the widespread criticism of the state of the health system in the lead-up to the budget.
One would have expected that with some quite extreme messages coming out about problems in PNG with the polio outbreak, with some increasing rates of TB and malaria, with the lack of medicines being provided out to health centres, one would have expected a significant increase in funding well above inflation in this particular budget. In fact, after allowing for inflation, health funding's been cut by 2%. So that certainly won't be enough money to try and reverse the problems in the PNG sector. It won't get more health workers out and available for health posts. It won't be enough to start rebuilding the decline in rural health centres that seems to be part and behind the low immunisation rates that are creating issues such as polio.
And the opposition again criticised the amount spent on hosting the APEC summit, saying it wasn't opposed to the summit itself, rather the cost. The PNG government allocated $330 million Australian dollars over 3 years to pay for it, but in 2016 the IMF estimated it would cost closer to $1.5 billion. But Paul Flanagan says the final number remains elusive.
That report from Lauren Baldy, and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. The first president of Kiribati has accused the nation's current leader of withholding a report into last January's shipping disaster when an inter-island ferry went down shortly after leaving port with the loss of at least 88 people. As Yara Mary Atfield reports, Pacific Beat understands the findings have been ready for some time, but under the laws of Kiribati, the president is under no obligation to make them public.
The sinking of the MV Busaroy was the maritime tragedy that shook the population of Kiribati. The ferry was heading from the island of Ninos towards the capital, South Tarawa, when it sank, with the loss of more than 80 of those people on board. One of the country's founding fathers, Sir Yeremia Tabai, is the Member of Parliament for Ninos, and he says many of his constituents lost their entire families.
Their world has changed. They have to pick up their pieces now, because they've lost a wife and they lost a kid. That's a real disaster.
It's now been 10 months since the privately owned ferry departed in mid-January on what was supposed to be a two-day journey, and the residents of Ninos still don't know why the ship went down. A commission of inquiry was established by the government, and early reports suggested that the boat was unseaworthy and overloaded, and the skipper and crew had been drinking. Sir Yeremia says the current president, Tanes Mamau, has had the completed investigator's report on his desk for some time, but no one from Parliament or the public has seen it. He says he's been making regular contact with the office of the president, but all he's been told is that it's not ready to release.
My view is that the government is trying to hide the fact that it is responsible for that. For one, they allowed the boat to go into the ocean when it is unseaworthy. And the government should have been able to stop the boat from sailing. And that is a responsibility under the law. The second one, when the accident happened, they did not respond until after 1 week. It's too late. People have died already.
Pacific Beat has made repeated requests for comment from the Office of the President, and they didn't provide a promised statement by deadline. But it's understood the President has no obligation to make the report public under the law.
Oh, for me, I'm hoping that that's out of all that investigation. They finally worked it out, what was the cause of it.
Juanita Limpus's nephew, Philip, was on the ferry when it sank. She says it took her family months to reconcile the fact that he may not be coming home.
My sister was hoping, and I think even just maybe a few months ago, that she finally kind of succumbed to the feeling that maybe he's not coming back. And I think that's really sad, but, you know, I suppose that's life. I mean, we are not the only families that suffered. There's a lot of them.
Ms. Limpus is a co-founder of the Kiribati Australia Association, and she says she's not blaming anyone. She just wants answers so similar tragedies can be avoided in the future.
I know, I'm sure they're doing their job, but, you know, please let us know. That's all we're asking. Let us know so those people are not dying in vain.
Longtime Kiribati resident Chuck Corbett agreed many of the survivors and family members of the victims still want answers as to how the boat went missing. But in the meantime, he says he's seen evidence that the tragedy has brought about a change in the way people travel.
We've seen government really take a strong, active role to reinforce safety here. We've seen the small ferries that work out of Tarawa. I've seen them with a life jacket. I've seen e-perbs for sale in some of the stores. I've seen them tightening up the laws so that they're no longer carrying benzene, gasoline, with passengers on ships and ferries.
The government came under fire in February for preventing New Zealand journalist Michael Mora and his camera crew from reporting on the tragedy, and for telling an ABC reporter it would not be appropriate for them to fly to the country to cover the story. Joshua McDonald is a freelance journalist who applied for a visa to cover a story about mental health in Kiribati, but he was knocked back too, with an official saying, "We cannot consider the case at this time."
Yeah, I got pretty sick of it. It seems like they just were trying anything they could to stop me from going, so I just gave up.
The final sitting of Parliament for the year began on Monday, giving MPs their last opportunity to debate the disaster before the new year.
Yara Murray-Atfield reporting. So for now, at least, the official reasons for January's ferry disaster are known only to a select few. The government of Palau markets the country as a pristine paradise, but the people of Narralong State are fighting to preserve their piece of that paradise by overturning plans for a massive sand mining project. The people of Narralong are trying to undo a done deal, one that was signed off by the previous governor with the Japanese company RAM. The present governor, Richard Nigratgrang, says he only found out about the agreement during his successful election campaign. And as more details of the plan have filtered through to the local community, so the outrage has grown over the potential impact on what is the most abundant and productive reef in Palau. That outrage came to a head at a public forum organised by Anne Singeo, Executive Director of eBill Society, a non-profit organisation for environmental protection and conservation.
The proposed project for sand mining is extreme. It is huge. Two states together create the same size of the area that's going to be impacted.
The area earmarked for mining is critical for the local community in terms of subsistence fishing and food gathering. The mining contract has a 50-year lifespan and RAM can take an unlimited amount of sand. But Anne Singeo says the deal is such that there may be precious little return for the Narralong people.
We've also heard that this project may be linked to other major development projects that are proposed to take place in Palau. And so if they do decide to just use the sand to build those structures to support the development, then they're not selling the sand. And so in the end, Narralong has just given away all its coastal waters to a Japanese company to mine for free for the next 50 years.
Governor Nigratgrang told the forum he can't do anything with the agreement, but he offered some encouragement by saying that if there's something that needs to be fixed, it's up to the community. Now doubt has been cast over the deal itself, with suggestions that while it was endorsed by the local assembly, it may not have gained the two-thirds majority required. And Roxanne Blessam, executive officer at the Environmental Quality Protection Board, says there is also a question mark over water grading, which could prevent the scheme from going ahead.
The public has time to review a change in the rules, and if there are comments, then the applicant is required to respond to those. The board takes the comments from the community very seriously, and that's why the board tried to get as much comment as possible on the project.
And Singeo says another factor at play is the threat mining would pose to some of Palau's most endangered species.
The people of this community have taken care of the area very well. A lot of the observations and studies have noted the area to be a critical marine habitat for some of the most critically endangered species like the Palau dugong. Not only that, it is a major feeding and nesting ground for hawksbill turtle, which is also a critically endangered species.
Governor Nigratrang has issued a clarion call to the people of Narralong to press for a public hearing and to explore the possibility of court action. At the EQPB, Roxanne Blessam says a public hearing could well be crucial for the local community in their fight to get the mining project overturned.
We sent out the environmental assessment to 14 agencies in Palau, and of course, Narralong State Government, Legislature and Office of Governors. And we did receive a lot of comments on this project with the request that there be a public hearing on this project. The site is very important to the community, and the community want to know in detail what the project will entail.
The RAM Group have apparently already invested $1.8 million in mining equipment, but the Narralong people appear determined to ensure that that equipment is never put to use unless major changes are made to the sand mining contract, and maybe not even then. I'm Richard Hewitt, and you're listening to Pacific Review. It's been described as a monumental plan that will change the country forever. That's the Papua New Guinea Electrification Project, which has a target of connecting 70% of PNG by 2030. Australia, working with the United States, Japan and New Zealand, will bankroll the initiative, which also aims to expand internet coverage at the same time. It's ambitious and expensive, but as Bill Bainbridge reports, specialists in the field say it is doable.
At just 13%, Papua New Guinea has one of the lowest rates of electrification in the world. Not only that, there's a power outage somewhere in the country on average 42 times a month. By comparison, Solomon Islands has just 5 outages a month. Development experts say it's a serious impediment to improving the country's welfare. Michelle Kerf is the World Bank's country director for the Pacific Islands and Papua New Guinea.
Kids won't study at night if there is no access to electricity, or hospitals are not going to be able to function properly in zones that are not electrified. You can imagine the impact that it has to live without electricity. So both for economic development purposes and for welfare reasons, this is a key objective.
He says providing 70% of the population with electricity by 2030 won't be easy or cheap.
What is for sure is that it's an ambitious target, and the price tag associated with that is quite high. We have estimates something around $1.4 to $1.7 billion.
He says extending the current electricity grid is feasible to populated areas, but in some of the mountainous and low-density areas, other solutions need to be found.
It can be mini-grids, which are not connected to the grid, but you have a mini-grid basically electrifying, say, a village, or when the density is really very low, where mini-grids would actually be relatively costly, a cheaper option is to look at technologies that can be deployed household by household, such as photovoltaic systems.
Subrata Barman leads the International Finance Corporation Energy Program in the Pacific. He says the project should also focus on weaning villages off their reliance on expensive diesel generation.
Not only in PNG, but overall in the Pacific, we have seen that most of these plants are being run on diesel, right? It is more costly, I know there's a lot of logistics involved, and the idea is to see how we can bring in other technologies which can complement diesel and reduce its usage to the extent possible.
The World Bank's Michelle Kerf says PNG should aim for a high percentage of renewable energy, including hydropower, solar and geothermal. But he says PNG could better use one resource it already has in abundance.
We believe PNG should be looking to use some of the gas which it is currently exporting for domestic electricity generation. So in the immediate term, I think gas, which is probably the cleanest form of fossil fuel, should be part of the energy matrix. But as time goes on, with a higher and higher share of the energy matrix taken on by things like geothermal and hydro, and therefore purely renewable.
But the plan goes beyond simply bringing power. It will simultaneously roll out internet access. PNG's government is yet to provide any detail on how that will be done. Andrew Kiddu was formerly an executive at Digicel. He says current internet-capable 3G mobile penetration reaches around 30% of people and around 60% of PNG's landmass, while those figures for 4G mobile are 10% and 35% respectively. He says it would make a lot of sense to roll out fibre optic cable alongside the grid extension.
If you use other technologies along with the fibre, mobile technologies and Wi-Fi, things like that, and I think it's achievable.
He says while it's difficult to estimate the cost of bringing internet to 70% of the country, the terrain of PNG makes it a very expensive proposition.
Building one mobile tower can cost between $100,000 US up to $400,000 or $500,000 US.
That's Andrew Kiddu, former senior counsel at Digicel in Papua New Guinea, ending that report from Bill Bainbridge. Finally, when two new international soccer competitions were launched in Europe and North and Central America, there was plenty of scepticism about how and if they would work. Well, so far, so good. The aim of more competitive matches in both regions has been achieved, crowds have been good, and some of the lesser-known teams have pulled off some shock results. So, could this Nations League model be replicated in the Pacific? The Oceania Football Confederation say their whole competition structure is under review, and at this stage the possibility of an OFC Nations League being created along the lines of the European and American models is on the table. But what those confederations have that OFC doesn't is a substantial pot of money, and to have the Pacific teams crisscrossing the region for international games is expensive, as Solomon Islands technical director Felipe Vega Arango can testify.
Flying 25 people to another country takes a lot of effort, and there are other ways of spending even more of the budget, like visas to go to countries. Applying for 25, 30 visas, it costs money as well. So the reality is that it's difficult.
But in at least two Pacific countries, Fiji and Papua New Guinea, they're pushing for professional leagues at club level. And the editor of the Football and Oceania website, Ola Bjorkavall, says establishing a new international competition should be part of that process.
If the nations themselves want to be more professional, then the OFC and, in extension, FIFA should do everything they can to help facilitate that, be that financial, be that coming with advice, because it's uncharted territory for all these nations.
And if it means getting an OFC Nations League off the ground, Fiji's national coach, Christophe Gamel, favours making a direct appeal to FIFA for financial assistance.
Yes, it's a good way to do, because all national team coach of Oceania have been called in London 2 or 3 months ago by FIFA to speak about that. For us, it was very important. You have to plan to create this project, and then if it's valid, I think it's possible.
Christophe Gamel believes it's time for FIFA to deliver on its pledge to grow the game. And with the Nations League up and running, Felipe Vega Arango says that would solve the problem of game time for all the Pacific nations, which is at a premium in between major tournaments.
You compare, for example, Spain or England, and they play 6-8, and also the rivals that they are playing. We cannot compare with them, but I think it's extremely needed that we play at least 4 or 6 of those games. And if we have some kind of tournament, even better, because then you play 6-8. For the Salomons, it would be ideal. Anything that is creating new competitions, I think is really positive.
We want to see the football growing in Oceania, so everyone has to take his part in this project. If we create a commune project, this new competition, it will be really good for everyone in Oceania.
Ola Bjorkavall is in no doubt that an OFC Nations League could work, and he says the American version has already demonstrated how such a competition can open the doors for less fancied teams to raise their game.
I think it's very feasible. I think they should do everything in their powers to make it happen. Because if you look at the success stories, Turks and Caicos, they won their first game in 4 years. Montserrat had back-to-back wins. Those are teams that are comparable to Tonga and Cook Islands. And the amount of attention they got around the world is something Oceania could also get. There's only pros with it. There are no negative sides.
And if, after they have completed their review, OFC opt to launch a Nations League, the hope is that fringe teams like Tuvalu and Kiribati, who only have associate membership status right now, would be allowed to compete alongside their bigger Pacific neighbours. And that's it for this edition of Pacific Review. You can podcast the programme and hear it at your leisure. I'm Richard Hewitt. Thank you very much for listening.